Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, I have a special treat. I have author James Washburn and also his agent, Jeannie Loyacano, is in the studio. James was born and raised in rural Wisconsin, initiating an intimate rapport with the natural environment and life in the North Country. Drawing from his connections to Native North American Indian and Inuit people, as well as a deep personal spiritual history and traditional Christianity, he weaves a story that transcends ethnicity and culture. He speaks to the universal desires of the human heart with simplicity and passion. Life is too important to spend it making a living, has been Washburn's mantra since youth. Choosing a three-decade career in education gave him time for extensive travel and experience with many of the most remote corners of North America. His appreciation for solitude and a self-reliant nature, however, belie his enthusiasm to promote an understanding of humanity's independence and the unity of all people. Washburn's education includes degrees in geography, health, and learning resources, along with extensive scholarly study in historical theology and psychology. He is also an able photographer and an experienced speaker. His current communion with Mother Earth has been a complete hike of the approximately 1,200-mile-long Ice Age Trail. And Jeannie calls herself a facilitator of dreams. Jeannie Loyacano represents over 60 authors. Forte is mystery, romance, thrillers, historical, military, and southern fiction, and all quality fiction and nonfiction. Her passion is to see her authors succeed. She says there's nothing more rewarding than to hold one of her authors' books and know she helped bring it to fruition. She says she is so blessed and privileged to be able to work with some of the most talented writers in the world. And she also says can't is not part of her dictionary. So I welcome both Jeannie and James. How are you tonight, James?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. I'm staying great, warm in my house.
That's great. It's that time of year, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yes. And Jeannie, how are you?
Great. We just got through with about 6 days of rain. Lots of flooding.
Oh, my. You're getting it down there in Texas. Well, James, I'm really interested in talking about your book, Touching Spirit. What brought you to write the book?
Well, David, I grew up in a fundamentalist home, Christian fundamentalist home. And sitting on my shoulder from as far back as I can remember, all the way up to middle age, was this little voice that kept telling me, you know, the division of the world doesn't have to be as it is. It seems as though, at least the religious corner that I grew up in, that religious corner divided the world into an in-group and an out-group. And all the while, my heart was telling me this just can't be true. This can't be the case. So I just fundamentally, that was the impetus for my starting to write this book. The book simply started out as a catharsis for me to get out my thoughts and things that I believe that the Spirit had led me to understand.
What are some of those things, James?
Well, I think the best thing for me to do right here with that question might be to simply read this one short section of the book.
Sure.
Sure. Now the book has two main characters. One is a white man, a middle-aged white man. And the other is an old grandfather of the First Nations people of Canada. First Nations are the people, are what the people refer to themselves in Canada. Here in the United States, we call the people Native Americans. This man is Ojibwa Cree, and I wrote his letters to this white boy, white man, in the vernacular of to try and add some authenticity to what he was saying. So if you hear a little incorrect grammar or so as I read, that's the way the book is written, to add legitimacy to it. So here's a short excerpt from the letter. Yes.
Before you get started on reading, can you check your phone? Because it sounds really muffled. We want to be able to hear you distinctly.
Thank you for the suggestion.
Is this a little better?
It's still a little muffled, but are you on a cell phone or on a landline?
I am on a cell phone. We do not have a landline.
That's okay.
Okay, then that sounds a little better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, go ahead, James.
Well,
I can hear you.
Can.
That's right.
So here's the old man speaking in this one of his first letters, writing to the young boy and explaining about the voice of the mind and the voice of the heart. And he says this is what I mean. Listen closely. When you are born, your heart knows the love and voice of the Spirit, and you are in harmony with it. But it has no human language. Spirit speaks to you the word of the Creator, but without a worldly tongue, and it has a form, but not a worldly speech. It has conversation with your being, but not with sound. Now, when you grow older, you learn other words made of sounds that come from the world, and you store them in your mind. You develop a language with them to sort out life and to understand this world. And soon the voice of the mind becomes louder, and you begin to listen to the words of this worldly tongue more and more and give it greater importance. This may be at the expense of the word that comes from eternity inside the center of your heart. After a while, with so many people, they think the only way to know things is with the word in their minds. So the word of the Creator in their heart gets pushed to the side where he waits for the fullness of time to be heard again. Many people, maybe most, are not in harmony. So I believe your question was, what was one of the major reasons for me writing the book? And as I grew up, the indoctrination that I experienced, the fundamentalist worldview in my mind was in constant conflict, an inner dissonance between my mind and my heart, which was telling me something else, that the world is one, the world is unified. And it took me nearly five decades to learn to listen to my heart. Because what I've discovered is that whenever the mind and the heart are in conflict, my heart has always been right. My mind can be shaped into any form, depending on the indoctrination environment that it grew up in. It can have any attitude or world view. But I believe that all people in their hearts understand the unity of humankind, our connection to the earth. And so one of the major reasons for me to put these things on paper was to give people the permission to listen to their hearts and to actually question the indoctrinations of their minds when it comes into conflict with what their hearts might be telling them.
I love that. That's beautiful. I very much embrace that philosophy, and I see things very much from the standpoint of ego versus spirit, which to me translates into the terms heart and mind, if you will. And I love the notion of unity and that we're all one at a core level. And I'd love to hear some more about the book. And then I would love to explore your spiritual background along with some other things, because I'm fascinated by somebody that comes out of a fundamentalist tradition who decides to break out of the mold, if you will, and embrace a little more, shall we say, loving approach to the rest of God's children,
yes,
instead of one that's divisive.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, let me give you a little bit more of the setting of the book. Is that okay?
That would be wonderful.
Okay. The setting of the book is in a remote area of north central Canada, in a small town called Broche. Broche has been a settlement for a couple hundred years, and initially a place where the First Nations people or Indians lived. And today there's approximately 250 people there, mainly First Nations people. So that's the setting of the book. It's located in northern Manitoba. And the book is laid out in short pieces. It's short letters of an old First Nations man writing to a young white adopted boy who lost his parents in northern Manitoba when they broke through the ice in the spring and were drowned, and he was adopted into the family of a mixed couple. The couple's name was James and Papili. James was Ojibwa Cree, and Papili is Inuit. And, of course, I tap my history for that. I have a son who is Inuit, and I associate with many Ojibwa and Cree people here. And so he's adopted into this family, and the old man, his great-grandfather, native great-grandfather, knows that he will not live long enough to transmit some of the things he's learned in life or some of the wisdom of his heart to this young boy, so he begins to write him letters. So these letters are short, vernacular type of correspondence to this young boy who still cannot read. And then throughout the book, as you read some of these letters, you get the response of the white man and how he has grown up. He has come back to the North. He has rediscovered these letters in middle age. And as he reads them, he begins to question his worldview. And from that perspective, then, his paradigm begins to shift. And so he responds in the book. After he reads a few letters, then he gives you his heart feelings. And then he reads some more letters and gives you his heart feelings about those letters. So it is I specifically chose to break it up in small segments like that because I believe most people today do not have large chunks of time just to sit down and read. Our modern lifestyle is very hectic. And so this way they can break off a little chunk, one letter or two letters an evening, and just eat on those, so to speak. So that's the style that the book is laid out in.
It sounds fascinating.
And I do want to say that the book is filled with Native American or First Nations wisdom and teachings that come out of their history. And it has been endorsed by such Native leaders as Dave Cochane, who is a First Nations spiritual spokesman in Canada, known throughout North America, actually spoken with the Dalai Lama several times at the United Nations G8 summit meetings and things like that. His native name is Ngani Aki Anini, and he's from Manitoba. And, of course, you've probably heard of this lady, Winona LaDuke. She ran for vice president here in America in 96 and 2000. She's endorsed the book. And Dennis Banks, his native name is Nawakama.
Oh, yeah.
Dennis Banks, he's established the American Indian Movement along with Russell Means back in the 70s. His name, Nawakamik, means center of the universe. And then there's Dan Hull, who's Sangade Makwa, is a strong heart bear. He's a leader here in the state of Wisconsin. So it was very pleasant for me to get the endorsement of these people and to say that, you know, the Native American teachings that are recounted in the book are not just something that's made up. They're not just romantic. If I could just read Dave Cochane's comment, his endorsement, he says this, and again, Dave Cochane is Ngani Aki Anini, which means leading earth man. This work reveals the spirit of the original free and independent peoples, the roots of our homeland. Touching spirit, the letters of Menominee, accurately reflects our connection to spirit and deep love of the land. Using values that transcend the separation and division we see in today's world, this book inspires one to join the original peoples who lead in helping to unite humanity and bring us all closer to the earth. And so that gives you a little history of the style and the way the book is laid out.
That was a beautiful passage. I love that. And, you know, I'm always quite enchanted with the notion of spirit because so many people seem to be disconnected from it. I haven't been privileged to read your book, but I was able to read a synopsis of it, and your book speaks of longing for inner peace, and to me that comes from spirit. How important do you believe that is for us in this life?
Well, today, most of humanity has lost connection with the earth. And to have connection with the earth is to, I believe, more closely have connection with spirit, because we've, let me just give you a quick bit of a statistic here. At the time that the Industrial Revolution began, 90% of the world, it was estimated, was rural. And today, 90% of the world has become urbanized. And so the mystery of life that we find in the creation is shielded away from us. When is the last time people, for instance, that live in a city could get down on their hands and knees and stare closely at the earth and see all the little spiders and the ants and all the different types of plants that are growing in the weeds, because their life is surrounded by concrete and glass. So that most of the world now, living in an urbanized environment, is cut off from this mystery, this beauty, this wonder. When you get down and you look closely at the earth, it's so incredibly amazing and complex that, again, mystery, which is a real connection, close connection, very similar to the things of spirit, were cut off more easily from spirit because we have no mystery in our lives. So that's just a comment I wanted to make there about the modern man versus the man of the past, 200 years ago and before.
It makes perfect sense to me. And yet I think there are so many people, whether or not they're aware of it, that are yearning for their spirits and trying to fill themselves up with people, places, and things that leave them ultimately feeling spiritually bankrupt, because they do attach themselves to outer conditions or things of this world, as opposed to something as simple as truth and love and even the earth.
Yes.
So there's a real disconnect. What do you think about that?
We become, I believe, at least modern man, especially in the West, the Western world, and the world itself is becoming Westernized. We're very analytical, very descriptive. We become trapped in our heads and disconnected in our daily life because of our isolation from the temple of creation. So as we live in our heads, as I mentioned early in one of the earliest readings here, we are not listening to the heart. And that, to me, the heart is what is in connection with spirit. Let me just look for another reading. Possibly this would fit into your question here. Yes,
okay.
Let me just find this. I'm going to turn in the book here. I'm almost there. Okay. This is a teaching, again, from one of the letters that the grandfather in Menominee K has written. And let me just preface this by saying the book is filled with allegories and juxtapositions of images that seem to be dualistic, but actually I use these opposites in order to show their unity. For instance, I use the allegory of the North as the place of spirit and the South as the place of materialism. So that being said, just let me read this short section. I think it has to do with your question. The world of the South has many beneficial things. Our Father has given them the gift to understand how things work and power to describe what they study. They have used this gift to make many hardships of life easier. This is often good, yet this power has a danger. Many are cut off in their mind from the unity that we are with all the creation. They are too much the observer and do not experience that they too are related to all things that they interact with. They can describe the world but cannot enter into being one with it, because they are always on the outside looking in. They explain and name things, but names stand in their way of being connected to these things. I have seen that these people of the South are not aware of their oneness with the world that they are looking at. They label and name things and put them into categories, but experience union with nothing. This way holds them back from knowing of their relationship to all things. They are split off and out of harmony with creation because they are detached observers. This is often true in a relationship to the divine creator too. There is much talk of him, but little connection and burning union with him. It is like a man and woman who live together in the same cabin, but seldom touch or talk with each other. And that's that section.
That's beautiful. I love your writing. It really touches me. And, Yes, yes. Would you please pronounce again for me the name of the grandfather?
Yes. Menominike?
Menominike. Menominike?
Menominike, yes.
Okay. Well, for people that are just tuning in, we're talking tonight with James Washburn, author of Touching Spirit, The Letters of Menominike. And I got it. Okay, good. And we're exploring a little bit about spiritual philosophy and the ways that we disconnect from feeling unified with all that is, with all of humanity, with all of the world. And I'm wondering, where is the best place for people to find your book?
It can be located at Barnes & Noble
and
or Amazon, and just look up Touching Spirit, the letters of, and if they can't spell the last word, that's just fine, it'll pop up. Touching Spirit, the letters of Menominike.
Okay.
And just as an aside, my native name is Menominike Gizismakwa, which means bear of the rising moon. And in case your listeners are interested, I'll just kind of describe that, in a, what that means to me.
Sure.
In the fall of the year, which is when the rising moon occurs, August, mid-August to mid-September, that's the time of the year when the wild rice here in the north-central U.S. and southern Canada is ready for harvest. And so it's symbolic, then, too, of the time of the year when there is plenty of food there. It's there for the taking. And Menominike Gizismakwa, or Bear of the Rising Moon, refers to a bear who was woken up in the spring and gorged himself by eating all summer long, and especially in the fall, he puts on a lot of fat and he's getting ready for the winter sleep. And so from a spiritual standpoint, it is descriptive of me that I spent 5 decades of my life searching and feeding, if you will, on many spiritual commentary and studying theology. And it came a time in my life when enough was enough. And so an acquaintance of mine, Sangade Makwa, which means strong heart bear, had a ceremony and gave me this name in order basically to tell me, Menominike Gizismakwa, you've had enough. It's time to rest in all that you have fed on. And there's really no need to be searching, but just in the love that you found in Creator. And so that's what a little bit of the history behind my native name.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I would be very... Is there anything else that you'd like to add about the book before we move on?
Well, when I wrote the book, I was very concerned about romanticizing the Native American voice in here. And mm-hmm. so I attempted strongly to introduce the struggles that the old man had, in which he would appear to be much more human. The old man's letters are really an everyman voice or an every woman voice. He goes through describing angers and fights that he was in and the loss, deep grieving over the loss of children and perplexity and not able to understand what life is about at times. And this is, so I wanted to give him a voice that the reader could identify with. But then I also wanted him to have a voice of wisdom. So to speak, he is a voice of the spirit. And enough said. That's one of the things I wanted to do there. The book is not meant to be a primer on Native American cosmology, but it's meant to speak to these common threads of existence, whether you are Native American, First Nations, Chinese, Mongolian, or Bushman of southern Africa. In all of our lives, whatever culture we live in, we have certain questions that we, you know, deep questions, the meaning of life, and why is there pain, or things of that nature. And so I wanted to make sure that everyone could identify with the wisdom that's translated in the book.
Wonderful. Well, I'm interested in exploring your own spiritual journey, because it sounds like it has been a fascinating one. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about how you grew up in a fundamentalist tradition and came to question some of the things that you may have learned and sought out greater truths?
Sure. Well, I was born in 1949, and some of my earliest recollections that I have are of sitting in church and all these tall people standing up around me and singing hymns. And I was probably 4, maybe even 3 years old. So these are some of the earliest things that I can remember. And we would go to church on Wednesday nights. We would go to church on Sunday mornings. We would go to church on Sunday nights. And it was, I was steeped in biblical education. And in a way, and I don't look back at that as something I wished I could have avoided. Not at all. I view that as part of the, you know, the puzzle, that every piece in every person's puzzle of life is necessary to make them what they are. We're all unique souls, so to speak. I heard a philosopher once attributed with the lines, if God is in the business of soul making. Well, I'm not quite sure totally what he meant by that, but I embrace every portion of my life that I went through, even though I look back at it now, and some of those aspects I see as, well, I definitely moved on from that, and I'm glad I have. But it's not something I reject. I accept it into part of my journey. So anyway, sure. I grew up in this fundamentalist home, and I was I don't know how to say it. I hope I don't offend too many people, but I was a Bible-thumping, evangelical, hellfire, brimstone preacher, if you will. Not literally a preacher, but I did have a ministry for a number of years, reaching out to younger people. And all that time, as I mentioned earlier, for the first 50 years of my life, I wondered, why is it that I have to look out there in the world and judge everything as in or out of the graces of God? It just doesn't seem that a God, that is the one who is speaking to me in my heart, would be this ogre in the sky waiting to thump us if we do something wrong, and if we don't get all our P's and Q's in a row, especially a mental matrix about a specific belief system, that is going to fry our puny little asses forever. It just didn't make sense to me. And of course, I lived in this thought ghetto of fundamentalism for decades. And one year I decided enough was enough, and I sat down and deprogrammed myself by looking at other people's views of biblical issues. And that was the start. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wondered what caused you to do that. I apologize for the interruption.
Oh, I was introduced to the idea of Christian universalism and what is called preterism. And that is the concept that all of the prophecies, biblical prophecies, have been fulfilled. It's over. It's done. If you will, as Jesus said on the cross, it is finished. And from that point on, once I started looking into that viewpoint, things began to fall into place. It gave me a better approximation of the truth that I felt was in my heart, a better approximation to universal love, that this is the God I know. It's not, I really don't know this again, this ogre in the sky. And so once I began to investigate these other ideas, and I became very open, I no longer feared looking into different opinions, different theological opinions, different religious opinions, whether they be Jewish or Islamic or Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, and I saw these common threads running through them all. And I've attempted to grab onto those threads and weave myself a rope that I can hang on to. And it just speaks so much more to my heart than this narrow thought ghetto, this narrow worldview of fundamentalism. And I believe we see where fundamentalism leads us. We have fundamentalist Islam, we have fundamentalist Christianity, and if I may make a generalized statement, we become the God we worship. And if we worship a God that will torture us for eternity, we worship a God who divides the world into accepted and unaccepted, okay, not okay, good or bad, we'll begin to do the same. And we dehumanize the world around us and the world as a whole.
That's beautiful.
That is beautiful. Is there anything you'd like to say about that, Jeannie?
Well, he just makes so much sense. Jesus was all about love. You know, when he came about, he said, you know, don't think about the past. In other words, don't think about, you know, all the hatred and the wars and stuff. Think about love. Love your enemies. And so what he's saying is you can't have a God that will punish you for being bad. He's always there. He's always got your back.
Yeah.
So how can he be mad at you? He can't be mad at you because he's love. Love has, you know, in Corinthians 13, it's all about love. So, I mean, it's just very hard for me to accept the fact that God will punish you. God doesn't punish you. You punish yourself.
Yes.
You know, and it's not necessarily the devil doing it. It's you doing it to yourself.
Yes.
You make yourself feel guilty. You make yourself feel bad. It all changes with your thoughts. You think good thoughts, you say good words, you have good actions.
Well, the thoughts lead to the words to the actions, and boy, what we think is what our experience tends to become. You know, I had somebody on my show who said, you think, therefore you are.
Exactly. Manifest
yeah.
it. Pep talks
right.
about that in the book a lot, you know, manifesting what your thoughts are going to be. And I have to tell you, I was reading Pep's book the same time I was reading this book by Neil Donald Walsh, What God Said. And I'm telling you, the chapters paralleled one another. Pep's was more of, the wording was more heartfelt, more something that a grandfather would tell you, you know, someone who would hold you in your arms and love you, like God holds you in his arms to comfort you. That's what I got from his book. It wasn't like an academic, you do this, you do that. It was more
mm-hmm.
like, experience this and you'll know. I mean, I just
yes.
absolutely love Pep's book, and I've bought it for so many people already for Christmas, so... Yeah, it shows.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Well, I know, you know, I adore you, Pep. I just think you're awesome.
Well,
Jeannie touched on something that reminded me If I may read from another letter of the old man. Okay. When we come in contact with, when we have an overshadowing, an inner experience, if you will, with this transcendent love of the Creator, of Gichi Manadu, of God, something happens inside of us that frees us to really be alive. We no longer have to be as protective, driven by our egos. We can be vulnerable, and we can live, if you will. This is getting me into this letter that I'm going to read. We can be naked before the world without shame. So let me just read this letter here. Okay, the old man is recounting a time when he saw the young boy running naked on the shores of this lake. And he says this: "There were no mosquitoes out or flies because there were frosts, but it was warm, so you were playing on the shore without any clothes. This was a picture of your place on your journey of life. You are innocent and free. You are knowing nothing of being ashamed because you are living in the voice of the teacher who tells you of the benevolence of all things. There is nothing to fear, and you accept life as full of joy, and there's no concern of tomorrow. Even when there's pain, it's received and experienced, and you go back to playing on the shores of the Lord. Being with no clothes is as it should be. There's no reason to cover up our beings. There's no feeling of shame or fears. Life is beautiful and full of wonder. But this is not where we stay as we grow. Other voices come in and we begin to listen to them. Slowly we begin to live in them and hear less of the great Father's voice telling us, all is okay, I love you. It becomes harder to take off our clothes and play, and we do not trust the love of our Creator inside our heart or in creation. We start to make everything complex, and life loses innocence, and maybe pains and fears make us close up like a clam. We think it's necessary to protect ourselves. We grow insecure. The heart gets caught like in one of my traps that clamps onto the leg of a mink, or like a snare that catches the waboose, the rabbit. For some who have a cruel childhood, or are taught wrong, or have a hard grief, the trap and snare hold them very tight. For some, they can recall the freedom and acceptance, but it is still complicated to be naked again and to be carefree in this loving universe. This is where most people live the big part of their lives. They're not aware of the goodness of the Creator, and so they must have control over their world to feel secure. Many also look for happiness by getting many possessions. These things eat up their life and cause forgetfulness of where deeper joy is found, by resting in the arms of our Maker. It is very much this way in the South Country. You will know this in life. It is for all people to travel this path, more or less resisting and not listening. It's the privilege of all people to experience this journey, but hopefully without resisting. Our animal relations do not have the honor of a path of learning. The gift of their journey is already opened for them on their walk, as I had said. Our journey never stops. As we walk our life path, we are to come to be enlightened that control and possessions and fear and insecurity are an illusion that keep you from seeing Creator's real life and freedom in His universe. This freedom of life can seem to be a hard thing to find again, but it is right there as our inheritance. It is freely for us to live in and rediscover. It is always right in front of us, but sometimes it's hard to see, like the tracks of a small bird in the sand. It has never been taken away, but being human means it is allowed to be hidden so we can know the wonder of its beautiful joy. You can always walk on the shores of the Lord naked.
Oh,
beautiful.
Wow.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I mean, that whole notion of joy, I think, is so important. And that was just filled with so much love and wisdom and common sense. And it seems to me that things of the Spirit really are commonsensical, if you will, if there is such a word, because we as humans, we complicate things so much, and spiritual reality really is more aligned with simplicity, and that just really was like a salve, a balm for my own wounds to listen to that.
Good.
I thank you so much for sharing that.
Good.
Yes. Are there any other passages from the book you'd like to read?
Sure. You want me to read the whole book?
Actually, you can get it on audio, and you can listen to it in the car anytime you want to, David.
There you go. That's great. Well, I think I'm going to have to get it. There's no question about that.
There are audio clips on both the Lawyer Kind of Literary Agency site and PEP site where you can hear excerpts of the book.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
Just so you know, the audio book, PEP is actually Menomake, and Robert Foster is Tilakagagi. So you actually hear PEP's voice throughout the book. He's the grandfather.
Yes, and I had the privilege of spending a week with the other man who is the young voice on the audio book. And we did some kayaking, and we saw otter and eagles and turtles and all kinds of mink and other creatures as we were prowling around the woods here. You asked if I wanted to read something else. Let me read you about a dream.
Okay.
I'll just go right into this. I dreamt I was a little boy in my father and mother's cabin. She was sewing up a hole in my shirt right over where my heart would be. The hole was almost stitched up when she looked down at me, saying she was not going to finish it. So in my dream, she said she was going to leave a little opening so that the light could always get in. After I put my shirt back on, I wonder about this, and then my mother was gone, and I was all alone. The window and the door of our cabin were letting in the sun, and I saw her thimble on the table. I lifted up the thimble, and it came to my mind in the dream that the darkness under the thimble did not go out into the room and make things darker. This made me feel good. Then I saw an overturned rice basket in the corner. I went to it and turned it over, and the darkness was bigger under it than under the thimble. Still, the room did not get any darker when the blackness flowed out from under the rice basket. Over by the door was a big empty wooden barrel. I took off the cover, and still the room was filled with light. Even though there was much darkness inside the barrel, it could not dim the sunlight in the room. I was amazed that the darkness could not overcome the light. Then in my dream, I pushed a chair over to the barrel, and I crawled up inside, and I pulled the cover over my head. It was very dark, no light, even after my eyes adjusted and got bigger. I was sad and afraid, and I tried to lift off the cover, but it was too heavy, and it was stuck. I was in the barrel for a long time, and I was growing bigger, like I was aging and going through life. The darkness and breathing was oppressive. Finally, I think I could hear someone working on the barrel cover, and faintly, I hear the voice of my father. He lifted the cover just a little, and a bright, tiny stream of light peeked in. It shines into the hole left in my shirt by my mother, and I am filled with happiness. After I was free from the barrel, it was very strange, because the tiny, bright stream of light was now shining outward from the hole in my shirt and making the world brighter. So this is kind of an allegory that to tell us that, you know, we're going to go through dark and oppressive times in our life. That's what life is about. It's the privilege we have of being human.
Mm-hmm.
But even in those times, you know, we will be gathering light inside of us. We'll be learning light, so to speak. And we'll be able to shine that out at other people. So that was one of the dreams that the old man recounted.
I loved it. What about the duality that exists within us? Because we all have a shadow side. And I like to believe that light always overcomes darkness at a metaphorical level, too. What do you believe about that?
Light overcomes darkness.
Yeah, that light overcomes the shadow side of ourselves, that ultimately humanity prevails, that goodness comes out in the end. I like to believe and hope and that the light's always is shining forth and illuminates the shadows of the recesses of our minds, if you will.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I grow older, I believe that this is true in the lives of most people. We can look back when the testosterone levels in us males get to be a little bit lower. We can look back and we can begin to wonder why we behaved the way we did. And so, if you will, light is beginning to rise up and shine on those areas of darkness as we age. And I believe that when we are born, and this is spoken of in the book in what is called the Seven Fires Prophecy, which I recount in the book. But when we are born, there is no duality. All we know is oneness. We
right.
and the world are one. And as our, it is the privilege that we have been granted as human beings that we very quickly then begin to experience our separateness. And we begin to develop an ego. We learn that we can have our pains alleviated. We can have our desires met if we begin to behave certain ways, if we put on certain masks and do certain things. So we're traveling down this circular road to individuality. But it is I believe, the will of the Creator that we eventually come full circle back around to realizing that we are, again, one with all of creation, one with the Creator, that we do not have this division, that the ego, that necessary development to grant us an interesting journey, if you will, the ego presents generally an illusion. And that if we are given the privilege of living long enough, and for some it doesn't take too long, for others it takes a longer time, we can come back mm-hmm. around to realizing our oneness, to develop again a consciousness generally referred to in secular psychology as a Christ consciousness. If
mm-hmm.
there was anyone who was in control of his ego, it was Christ. And we see that exemplified at the cross, where he knew that he could set aside his self and raise up other people. And I believe that's what his life spoke of, the constant, perpetual setting aside of the self for the service of others, yet he retained his uniqueness. And, of course, he was mirroring, in my opinion, the nature and heart of the Creator, of God, of the Great Spirit.
I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. I'm interested in how you talked about how for some it takes a very long time to develop wisdom, if you will, and for others not so much. All of our journeys are unique, and we do form a most interesting tapestry, that's for sure. Can you tell me what some of the common threads were of the various religions that you studied that brought you to a sense of peace and coming to embrace that we're all one?
I would say that the common threads didn't necessarily bring me to that understanding. I discovered the common threads after I came to an understanding simply by listening within and putting
mm-hmm.
trust and faith in my own inner voice.
Mm.
And at that point, I'm not one to really jump into ideas very quickly, but this so resonated within me that I thought, I wonder if this is, let's say, contained in the mystics, the writings, the Christian mystics, contained in the Islamic mystics and their writing, and contained in Buddha. And sure enough, there it was. So that validated for me that I could listen to my heart, and my heart
yeah.
was okay. So I think that might answer your question.
It does. It truly does. It brings me full circle in terms of what I've come to discover for myself, too. And it was, I guess it was not exactly the best question to ask, but I am always interested in people that open themselves to take a look at other cultures, religions, what have you, to find a commonality, if you will. And I certainly believe that the truth comes from within, and that
yes.
we need to think with our hearts. That's so important. You know, I would love to interview you again. There's so much I would like to pick your brain about, and time is running short today. What is the best way for people to get in touch with you?
I have a website simply titled, all one word, theteacherwithin.com.
Beautiful.
Theteacherwithin.com. And on there is an email, theteacherwithin@gmail.com. So they can reach me that way as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I've really enjoyed the hour. It went very quickly, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Jeannie, thank you for joining us and for your comments.
You're quite welcome. I just have a goal,
yeah.
and that goal is to spend a week mind-melding with James Washburn. I was just going to spend a whole week just listening to him.
Ah,
well,
I could
not
do.
Sure. You have to understand that the book is a distillation, and usually I'm not very astute at verbalizing ideas.
Well, you certainly are a student of the soul, and you have a way with words that melts my heart, and I thank you for sharing.
Thank you, and you're welcome.
So once again, we
appreciate you, David.
What's that?
I said we so appreciate you.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.